Lamentations. If you'll find Lamentations right after Jeremiah. Isaiah, Jeremiah, then the book of Lamentations, which is an appendix, apparently, clearly written by Jeremiah as well, as there are so many correlations to it. And we're going to take a look at this little book. I want you to take a look for a moment, just picturing. Of course, you can see the picture up there now. This is actually a Rembrandt on the screen of Jeremiah sitting on the rock lamenting at the fall of Jerusalem. This is really what this book is about. Jeremiah the prophet expressed this was going to happen in his prophecies. And now it's happened. Now, you would think he'd be excited. Hey, now they all know I'm a true prophet. They've been imprisoning me and beating me and hurting me and accusing me of being a traitor and all of these things my whole life I've been going through. Now I'm proved right. You could see a logic in that response, but you don't find that in Jeremiah. You find his truly a heart of God, has the love of God, and he cares for people, and it grieves him that he's right. I mean, it's one of those things where there's a lot of things the Bible predicts you wish that weren't right. So Jeremiah is lamenting the destruction of the temple in the Jerusalem by the Babylonians. They're still now lamenting and wailing and discouraged over that destruction and hoping for a rebuilt temple in Jerusalem. So I just want to give you those pictures and you can throw those. There's a few of them that you can just kind of get a different perspective of that wall. So here we are in Lamentations. Now, in a sense, this is like a funeral service. In a very real way, the key thought here is that everything that's happened, happened just as God said it would. Just as inevitable as his word will come to pass in every area of our lives, and eventually that one day we will die. And so a funeral service is like that. It's helpful for us. It's instructive for us to learn. It's written in a poetic form. Hebrew poetry, different from our poetry, not rhyming words, but rhyming thoughts. And in this particular poetry, it's even more fascinating if in the Hebrew that it's an acrostic. Every verse begins with the letter of the alphabet of the Hebrew. There's 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, so 22 verses in each chapter. With the exception of chapter 3, there's 66 verses because it's three verses with the same letter. It's repeated over and over again. Clearly, Jeremiah is lamenting the sadness, the crisis, the consequences of the sin of the people. And this is instructive. You know, just as we were attending a funeral this morning, the funeral isn't for the person who's passed on. The funeral is for those that are there so that they can learn. And in a way, looking at this lament, looking at this heart's cry, as you see, even Jerusalem itself cries, it's personified as crying out to God for mercy and help and grief and pain. It's instructive for us. On a famous tombstone in the old Irwin Cemetery near Crested Butte, Colorado, is the famous epitaph. My dear friends, as you pass by, as you are now, so once was I. As I am now, soon you must be. Prepare yourselves to follow me. Kind of eerie. Now, I think it's kind of cool to go through a cemetery and look at some of the tombstones, what people write, their last words, their epitaphs. I know you might think it's morbid, but it's a cheap date, actually. There's this one cemetery over in Freehold, Tenant Church. They've got a cemetery around the church. It's actually the church where George Tenet and a number of the revivalists spoke there. Tremendous place. And going back in the history of our nation. But some of the things that are written on those tombstones, fascinating. Fascinating things, because you can learn from someone. You know, it all ends there for all of us eventually. So what have we learned? What are we gaining from this? The key for this book is don't waste your sorrows. When you go through trials and difficulties and pains, and of course, you can also do that vicariously by reading this. You can feel their pain and their hurt and their sorrow. And that's a good thing because you can then learn from it. You should squeeze every drop of lesson out of this so as not to have to face the same things. So Jeremiah expresses these things in verse 1. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. How like a widow is she who was great among the nations, the princess among the provinces, has become a slave. She weeps bitterly in the night. Her tears are on her cheeks. Among her lovers, there's none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. In the background of this little book is something that you have to know. God raised up his nation to be a nation of power and prestige so that all the world would know the power and the love of God. And under the time of David, it was an amazing nation, influential throughout the world. And Solomon, well, even the Queen of Sheba comes from the south to find this wisdom of Solomon. Tremendous influence, but shortly thereafter, they lost their influence as the nation divided in the days of the son of Solomon, Rehoboam. Jeroboam took the 10 nations to the north, Rehoboam to the south, the two tribes rather. And Israel, the nation of the north with the 10 tribes, there were 19 bad kings. Half of them committed suicide or were assassinated, and eventually they were conquered by the Assyrians. But Judah had a lot of hope. There were some declines. There were 4 periods of decline, but there were 3 great revivals that kept the nation going for hundreds of years, even beyond the nation of Israel. 20 kings, 8 of them were really good kings. But eventually the last decline was too much. Under the time of Josiah, there was hope. But after he died, in the time of Jeremiah, when he preached, bang, 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 bang. Every king that came on the throne quickly disposed and evil, and eventually Babylon came, and they find themselves now taken into captivity. In this time of decline, as he's describing here, that they've gone into captivity, verse 3, he says, Judah has gone into captivity under affliction and hard servitude. She dwells among the nations. She finds no rest. All her persecutors overtake her in her dire straits. In this time, all the politicians were essentially just self-serving. They weren't listening to the prophet. They were only listening to the false prophets. Jeremiah lamented, "My people have committed 2 evils, said the Lord. They've forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and they've hewn for themselves cisterns that can hold no water." Cracked cisterns. As people carve out for themselves all the time little philosophies that they place themselves in, and they live in that philosophy of life. But the problem is it leaks. It can't really hold any real life. You need a living water from the Lord in your life because he created you. He goes on to say, the roads to Zion mourn because no one comes to the set feasts. All her gates are desolate. Her priests sigh. Her virgins are afflicted. She's in bitterness. Her adversaries have become the master. Her enemies prosper, for the Lord has afflicted her because of the multitude of her transgressions. Her children have gone into captivity before the enemy. And from the great daughter of Zion, all her splendor has departed. Her princes have become like a deer that find no pasture, that flee without strength before the pursuer. I mean, this is very picturesque language, but you see the reason here in verse 5. Why this affliction? In the book of Job, it's a book of suffering by an individual. And the lessons there, here's a man who hasn't done anything wrong, yet he's still suffering in this life, but the things he learns help him for eternity. In Jeremiah, the book of Lamentations, you find a book of suffering as well, a picture of suffering, and something we wouldn't normally talk about necessarily. But it's a national suffering, and the suffering is a result of the transgressions. And of course, we learn in Galatians, be not deceived, God is not mocked. Whatever you sow, you're going to reap. You sow to the flesh, you're going to from the flesh reap corruption. If you sow to the Spirit, you'll of the Spirit reap everlasting life. So there's a lesson here for us. Now in verse 7, one of the most painful lessons is discovered here. In the days of her affliction and roaming, Jerusalem remembers all her pleasant things that she had in the days of old, when her people fell into the hand of the enemy with no one to help her, and the adversary saw her and mocked at her downfall. You know, the hardest part of going through a trial is remembering how wonderful it was before the trial. That's the hard one. But we're there sometimes. Jerusalem has sinned gravely, therefore she's become vile. All who honored her despise her because they've seen her nakedness. Yes, she sighs and turns away. It's a picture of just utter shame where she's exposed in her nakedness. She's embarrassed and turning around to cover herself. Her uncleanness is in her skirts. She did not consider her destiny. Therefore, her collapse was awesome. She had no comforter. O Lord, behold my affliction, for the enemy is exalted. There is, in a sense, the real problem with this lamentation. is that Jerusalem did not consider their destiny. They didn't really think of the outcome of the decisions they were making. Do you ever think of the consequences of a decision before you make a decision? If you don't, you're going to learn the hard way. But if you think ahead, now, if I do this, what will it mean? If I indulge myself here a little, how will that affect me? How will that affect my family? What will that mean to me? If I'm found out, what will occur? Just be sure your sin will find you out. If you know that as a Christian, you will do well, because you'll know that everything you do will eventually be public knowledge. It will happen. It's just a matter of time. It's as soon as sin gets a hold of you, it's eventually going to take you. And Jeremiah lamented in Jeremiah 5 about how the astonishing and horrible thing has happened. The people were listening to the false prophets. And he says, but what will you do in the end? And that's a great question to ask. And that's why we come to this funeral service this morning here in the Book of Lamentations. What are you going to do in the end? Where will you be? Where will you find yourself? What will your epitaph be? This is instructive. In Proverbs, it shows the man who commits adultery, lacking sense, and then after his flesh and his body are consumed, he goes, oh, how I hated instruction. How I despised correction. I didn't obey the voice of my teachers, and I was on the verge of total ruin. Because he didn't consider his end, and that's exactly where Israel is. They did not consider the end. Where does it all end? Where is it going to end? That's what was not considered. And notice he says this. The adversary has spread his hand, verse 10, over all her pleasant things. She's seen the nations enter her sanctuary, those you commanded not to enter your assembly. You know what's sad? Well, the end of verse 9, you know, about she had no comforter. The collapse was awesome. It says, oh, Lord, behold my affliction, for the enemy's exalted. The biggest problem was that all of her enemy that had brought this upon her, in her estimation, was worse. And so she's frustrated with that, that they've now come in to defile the sanctuary. And then her response from a personal level, verse 11, all her people sigh. They seek bread. They've given their valuables for food to restore light. See, O Lord, and consider, for I am scorned. I mean, how horrible that would be. Can you imagine that scenario where you've got all of your valuables and you're basically handing them over for a loaf of bread just to live? You're desperate. Now, in the first 11 verses, there is this description. But the last 11 verses of the first chapter are actually now Jerusalem personified. In other words, now Jerusalem as a city is speaking and telling you of her own grief. Can you imagine being in this condition to be able to speak this? Listen to what she says in verse 12. Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? Picture yourself as a passerby. You're watching. You're looking at what happened in Jerusalem and you're going, wow, look at that city. Behold and see if there's any sorrow like my sorrow, which has been brought on me, which the Lord has inflicted in the day of his fierce anger. You know, it wouldn't have been hard to remember how powerful and how glorious they were in the days of Solomon. And now look at them. Rubble, ruins, fire, death, sickness. From above he sent fire into my bones and it's overpowered them. He has spread a net for my feet. Again, she's speaking. And turned me back. He has made me desolate and faint all the day. The yoke of my transgressions was bound and they were woven together by his hands and thrust upon my neck. He made my strength fail. The Lord deliver me into the hands of those whom I am not able to withstand. The Lord has trampled underfoot all my mighty men in my midst, has called an assembly against me to crush my young men. And the Lord trampled as in a winepress the virgin daughter of Judah. For these things I weep. My eye overflows with water because the comforter who should restore my life is far from me. My children are desolate because the enemy has prevailed. You know, the lesson in this is poetic. Because in all of the rejection and rebellion and the walking away from God, now it's just come back. And there is a mourning here. Now, the thing that's very instructive for us in mourning, I want you to turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Just back up through Isaiah, through Song of Solomon, and you'll come to Ecclesiastes. And you may have remembered this in our Ecclesiastes study. As Solomon wrote, something that we wouldn't normally consider, something that's very important for us as we're going through Lamentations to remember, lest we get discouraged. Verse 2 of chapter 7, it expresses, better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. See, it's better to spend your time at funerals than festivals, he's saying. For you're going to die, and it's good to think about it while there's still time to know what will the end be. Celebratory feasts and gatherings are oftentimes the point of temptation. But in mournful gatherings, we're often focused on thoughtfulness. Funerals are preferred, Solomon says, to festivals because one's a gateway to the temporary, the other is a gateway to the eternal. Think about the most indelible memories in your mind. Are they times of frivolity and fun and laughter, or are they times of great sorrow and depths of hurt? You see, the things that stick with you the most, the lessons, the greatest lessons, the ones, the time of brokenness. See, he goes on in verse 3 in Ecclesiastes and says, sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better. That's what we're about. Now, wouldn't you know, I'm tempted to avoid books like this. And just let's go into the happy scriptures. Let's go into the happy thoughts and let's talk about good things. But who doesn't like to laugh? No question about that. We enjoy laughter. Now, in our couples gathering, we had a lot of laughter and there was a great time and fun. But there's also the knowledge that laughter, even though it does good like medicine, it's better for sorrow. Nothing wrong with laughter. Great to have laughter. It's a medicine to the soul. But it's the premium, the high premium should be on sorrow because it's better. Sadness, not laughter, has a refining influence on us and the heart is made better. And then he says in verse 4, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of the fools is in the house of mirth. See, a wise person thinks about death. A fool only thinks about having a good time now. It's all that matters. Now, again, the Lord doesn't want us to be weighted down. He's not going to give these lessons and lamentations to depress us and frustrate us, but rather that we can be made better because we can put a lesson to this. And even in sorrows, there is a depth of joy. The conscience is satisfied in a sense because now you're listening to it. You're hearkening. You're listening closely to the voice of the Lord. Very healthy. The wise mourn while the fools party on. And so we need to learn this. Verse 17, back to Lamentations, chapter 1, verse 17. So Zion spreads out her hands, but no one comforts her. The Lord commanded concerning Jacob that those around him has become his adversaries. Jerusalem has become an unclean thing among them. But notice the understanding in verse 18, the Lord is righteous. Now this is Jerusalem expressing this. Jerusalem is not saying, how could you do this to us, God? This isn't fair. What's happening? Look at how painful this is. No, the Lord is righteous. You're right, God. For I rebelled against his commandment. Hear now, all peoples, and behold my sorrow. My virgins and my young men have gone into captivity. I called for my lovers, but they deceived me. My priests and my elders breathed their last in the city while they sought food to restore their life. This is an acknowledgement. I deserved it. You know, you can always tell true repentance has come when you're no longer striving with God about what's happened, but you acknowledge it. You're okay. You're like, Lord, I deserve this. I don't deserve the least of your mercies. When you cherish the mercy of the Lord because it's something you know, it's mercy. You didn't deserve it. It's grace. It's his favor upon you, even though you didn't deserve it. There's something amazing that happens in your heart. But the person who's not repentant will always be pointing the finger at someone else. Well, they made me do it. And well, you don't understand my situation. And it wasn't my fault. I'm only human. And it's always an excuse. So he says in verse 20, Jerusalem, see, O Lord, that I'm in distress. My soul is troubled. My heart is overturned within me, for I have been very rebellious. Outside the sword breathes. At home, it's like death. They heard that I sigh, but no one comforts me. My enemies have heard my trouble. They're glad that you have done it. Bring on the day you have announced that they may become like me. Let all their wickedness come before you and do to them as you have done to me. For all my transgressions, for my sighs are many and my heart is faint. What Jerusalem is saying here is that I have sinned. I've done wrong. But the enemy that's coming against us, they're evil too. And Lord, if you're going to deal with me, you've got to deal with them. That was the hard part. Because in the time that God was using Babylon to come and discipline his people, it was unheard of. It was unthinkable. Because the logic of it, why would God use a nation so evil as Babylon to punish his people? They're bad, but they're not that bad. And you know, that was what Habakkuk's struggle was. In the book of Habakkuk, that little tiny book that, you know, one day when you get to heaven and Habakkuk's going to ask you, did you read my book? You know, Habakkuk. You know, it's actually a fun book to read because you find Habakkuk struggling just like you would struggle. Like, why is there so much evil in this world? Lord, do something. And the Lord says, well, I'm going to do something. And he basically says, well, what are you going to do? And he goes, well, I'm not going to tell you because if I told you, you wouldn't believe me. And Habakkuk says, come on, tell me. So the Lord says, okay, I'm going to use Babylon to punish. You're worried about all that sin and evil in the nation? Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to use Babylon to punish them. And Habakkuk is like, what? You can't do that. They're worse than we are. How could you use those evil people to punish us? We're bad, but they're worse. And the Lord basically says, see, I told you, you wouldn't believe me. But essentially, the lesson for Habakkuk was to learn that the just will live by faith, to see through that discipline, to see through the sorrow, that God will eventually bring justice. And you can be certain that a lot of people in this nation think, oh, nothing would ever happen to America. We're basically good people. Certainly he wouldn't use a nation like Iran to humble us. Hey, just be aware that Iran has now done their latest missile test. They have a missile that can fly under radar, can avoid the missiles to bring it down, and can deliver targets, nuclear targets, to multiple targets. They can hit multiple with one missile. And we're in a very, very precarious place. We are much more vulnerable than we think. We have the technology, but our enemies don't need technology. They're determined. They almost destroyed our economy. 19 guys with box cutters almost destroyed the economy here in this nation. They've had a lot more time to think, to plan, to strategize. And though we have kept the war outside of these borders, still, nonetheless, we know it's a lot of things. And our media doesn't cover this stuff. It's sad. When I look at our media, it's kind of discouraging because they're more interested in covering when major news events are happening in the world. We've got O.J. Simpson and Lorena Bobbitt and Monica Lewinsky and all these scandals and all of these things. And it's not news. It's entertainment. And we're entertained. We're kept in a place of blindness. Avi Limkin really did a great job expressing this. But folks, where are we as a nation? Chapter 2 of Lamentations, just I want to run through real briefly, largely because I don't want to be in Lamentations forever, but also I want to see this picture together of this. Now the Lord's anger is expressed, and he says how the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger. He cast down from heaven to the earth the beauty of Israel and did not remember his footstool in the day of his anger. See, God is a just God who's incredibly patient. But he will not always strive with men. How many prophets did he send and they killed? How many people did he send to warn them? How many revivals did he send to the nation and they changed a little but didn't go deep enough? Opportunity after opportunity after opportunity. This is the Lord. He gives you plenty of rope, lots of space, lots of space. What will you do with that? Well, eventually that time will run out. And this is what happened with Israel. In fact, the thing that really struck was because they actually were worse before than they were under Josiah and the last few kings that they had. They were much worse. Under Manasseh's time, he was so bad. But, you know, the thing about Manasseh is that he was bad to the bone, but he knew he was bad to the bone. And he didn't try to pretend to believe in Jehovah. He just totally exchanged it for the worship of Baal, was very open with his sin, and at least he was honest. But in Josiah's day, when Josiah began the revival, and I believe Josiah's heart was right, but the people now were just in pretense. It was a religious pretense. Now, when you're bad to the bone, and you know you're bad to the bone, at least there's hope. At least you'll be like, okay, I need to get my act together with God. But if you're religious, and you think you're cool when you're living hypocritically, what do you do with that? That was the dilemma. They thought everything was fine. Even though the prophets were warning them, oh, Jeremiah, you know, we got other prophets that's telling us nice, pleasant things. We don't need to listen to him. God doesn't really mind. I mean, come on. It's not that big of a deal. Everybody does it. These were the things that were going around in the nation. Now, the same hypocrisy when Babylon eventually came in and took them. When you follow the history, eventually God brings them back. He's faithful. When they come back into the land, they get established again up into the time of Jesus. What's most prominent about the nation when Rome now comes in and destroys the temple? The same thing, hypocrisy. There's one thing the Lord hates. It's hypocrisy. He would rather have you blaspheme his name openly than praise him with an insincere heart. Think about it. He doesn't like hypocrisy. And you see that. That's when he eventually, because there's nothing else you can do now. You can't even convince a person to turn because they think, hey, relax. I'm cool. I'm okay. You can't tell them anything. We need to keep a tender conscience in this area. And that's the problem. Our conscience gets hard when we live in hypocrisy. So in verse 2, he says here, and the Lord swallowed up, not pitied all the dwelling places of Jacob, thrown down in his wrath the strongholds of the daughter of Judah. He's brought them to the ground and profaned the kingdom and its princes. He's cut off in fierce anger every horn of Israel, that is every power. He's drawn back his right hand from before the enemy. He's blazed against Jacob like a flaming fire, devouring all around. Standing like an enemy, he's bent his bow with his right hand and like an adversary. He's slain all who are pleasing to his eye. On the tent of the daughter of Zion, he's poured out his fury like fire. Strong words. Because it says here, the Lord was like an enemy. He swallowed up Israel. He swallowed up all her palaces. He's destroyed her strongholds and increased mourning and lamentation in the daughter of Judah. See, if our enemy has a plan to bring us down. You see, God puts a hedge of protection about his people. And so no enemy can attack his people. And Balaam understood this. He couldn't prophesy against Israel because God was protecting them. And so another strategy needed to be employed. You can't fight against God's people. But what you can do is get his people to reject God, and then he will fight against them. And you know, it's funny that we have national enemies. Enemies that don't like this nation, don't like our power and our prosperity. Largely, the prosperity and the power that we have in this nation is a result of this nation having strong Judeo-Christian ethic, having a strong right and wrong sense. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord. This nation has its roots in Christianity. But we're now far away from that. And it's been said, if God doesn't punish America, he's going to have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah. Because that's where we are now, in many ways. And so he expresses this. He's become like an enemy. He swallowed up her palaces, destroyed her strongholds, increased mourning and lamentation in the daughter of Judah. Verse 6, he's done violence to his tabernacle. That's shocking. That was the very place that he established so that people could come to him. As if it were a garden, he's destroyed his place of assembly. The Lord has caused the appointed feasts and Sabbaths to be forgotten in Zion. In his burning indignation, he spurned the king and the priest. The Sabbath is an interesting thing because the very time period they spent in captivity was related to their disobedience in regard to the Sabbath year. 70 years, Jeremiah said, you're going to be in captivity. Why? 1 year for every 7 that you didn't let the land rest. They were greedy. They were supposed to let the land rest every 7th year. That didn't mean that all of the land would rest at once, but you take your fields and you divide them in 7ths. And 1/7 of your land every year, a different part of the land, would go fallow. So you give the land its rest, which means you have 6/7 of your land to plow and to plant and to reap and to enjoy. But they were greedy and they didn't do that. And so the Lord said, 490 years in the land, you didn't honor the 7th year, now I'm going to take it. And I'm going to give the land its rest. You see, there's a lesson here. If you don't willingly yield your life, your resources up to God, then he'll take them. Then you get no credit for him. But if you willingly trust him with your life and your resources and you honor him with your tithes and you honor him with your service and you say, Lord, here am I. It's like the reward is yours. And it's amazing, the Lord's grace. But here they have so rebelled, now no one's going to even remember his Sabbaths. The Lord has spurned his altar. Verse 7, he's abandoned his sanctuary. He's given up the walls of her palaces into the hand of the enemy. They've made it a noise in the house of the Lord as on the day of set feast. Verse 8, the Lord has purposed to destroy the wall of the daughter of Zion. He stretched out a line. He has not withdrawn his hand from destroying. Therefore, he has caused the rampart and wall to lament. They languished together. Her gates have sunk into the ground. He has destroyed and broken her bars. Her king and her princes are among the nations. The law is no more, and her prophets find no vision from the Lord. A horrible picture. And yet, how much we as a nation are in danger unless revival comes. Folks, we're desperate for revival. If you know anything about how God deals with nations, you will be like, Lord, have mercy on our nation and our leaders. Bring us once again to revival. Talking about the doctrine of Balaam, do you know that the communist nation of Russia, when it was in its peak of communism, they had 45 goals that somehow got discovered, goals that they had for this nation, to demoralize our nation, to break our moral fiber and to break us, to bring us to nothing, to conquer our nation. 45 communist goals I mentioned to you some months ago, written in 1958 in the book The Naked Communist by Cleon Skousen. 45 goals in which if they would accomplish those goals, we would be a nation extremely vulnerable, which is what they wanted. And I read a number of them to you. I want to remind you, especially in this time of lamentation, to think about where we are. Because the sad thing is, though communism, in a sense, in the world is defunct in many opinions, but I'm not quite so sure. But even if it's not, these goals have been largely accomplished, which makes us extremely vulnerable to other enemies. And many of them were revolving around our morality. Some of the goals, I'm going to just mention the number that came in the list. Number 16 was to use technical divisions of the courts to weaken basic American institutions by claiming their activities violate civil rights. Done. Number 17, to get control of the schools. Use them as transmission belts for socialism and current propaganda. Soften the curriculum. Get control of teachers' associations. Put the party line in textbooks. 20. Infiltrate the press. Get control of book review assignments, editorial writing, policy-making decisions. 21. Gain control of key positions in radio, TV, and motion pictures. Continue discrediting American culture by degrading all forms of artistic expression. Listen to this. Eliminate all good sculpture from parks and buildings and substitute shapeless, awkward, and meaningless forms. Interesting. Number 23, control art critics and directors of art museums. Our plan is to promote ugliness, repulsive, meaningless art. Number 24, eliminate all laws governing obscenity. Now remember, this was written in 1958. Eliminate all laws governing obscenity by calling them censorship and a violation of free speech and free press. Number 25, break down cultural standards of morality by promoting pornography and obscenity in books, magazines, motion pictures, radio, and TV. And this is where we are. A lady told me in second service in Berkeley, and I checked this out on the internet, a number of universities, not just Berkeley and UCal, but also in some of the larger universities, even in the Midwest, have pornography courses where you can study pornography, watch pornographic films, and then debate and talk about the effect of pornography in the culture. I'm sure all the young men are going, I'll sign up for that class. Foolishly, but that is the here's amazing. Of course, when I was in college, I remember a human sexuality course, and it was degrading and disgusting as they showed pornographic films. Folks, this is amazing just where we are. Number 26, the goal of communism, present homosexuality, degeneracy, promiscuity as normal, natural, and healthy. Number 27, infiltrate the churches and replace revealed religion with social religion. Discredit the Bible and emphasize the need for intellectual maturity, which does not need a quote unquote religious crutch. Number 28, eliminate prayer or any phase of religious expression in the schools on the ground that it violates the principle of separation of church and state. Well, that was accomplished in 63. And this was actually brought out in 63 in Congress. And then the Supreme Court, of course, went through their decision. Number 29 of this, discredit the American Constitution by calling it inadequate, old-fashioned, out of step with modern needs and a hindrance to cooperation between nations on a worldwide basis. Watch the Supreme Court, how much they're leaning more upon international law in their decisions rather than the Constitution. Discredit the American founding fathers, number 30. Present them as selfish aristocrats who have no concern for the common man. Discredit the family as an institution. Encourage promiscuity and easy divorce. Emphasize the need to raise children away from the negative influence of parents. And then create the impression that violence and insurrection are legitimate aspects of the American tradition. These were just a few of the 45 goals that most all of them have been accomplished. Doesn't that make you a little nervous? Now, some of you are thinking that's got to be a hoax. It's not. I check 99% of the time when something comes through. I want to make sure it's not a hoax before I bring it from the pulpit. I say 99% of the time because every now and then I slip. But most of the time it's like it's you want to check these things. This is a legitimate truth. You can check this out. And you will find that it is true, and you can actually get these full 45 goals off the internet. Folks, where are we? What happened to Israel was because they rebelled, they walked away from the Lord, and because of that, the Lord himself disciplined them, his people. Where do we stand in this? Verse 10 of Lamentations. The elders of the daughters of Zion sit on the ground and keep silence. They throw dust on their heads, gird themselves with sackcloth. The virgins of Jerusalem bow their heads to the ground. God is going to be merciful. He's going to give them a glimpse of hope because they are now broken and repentant. My eyes fail with tears. My heart is troubled. My bile is poured out on the ground because of the destruction of the daughter of my people, because the children and the infants faint in the streets of the city. They say to their mothers, where is grain and wine? And they swoon like the wounded in the streets of the city, and their life is poured out in their mother's bosom. Kids dying in their mother's arms. Just a horrible time. He says, how shall I console you? To what shall I liken you, O daughter of Jerusalem? What shall I compare with you that I may comfort you, O daughter of Zion? For your ruin is spread wide as the sea. Who can heal you? Your prophets have seen for you false and deceptive visions. They have not uncovered your iniquity to bring back your captives, but have envisioned you for false prophecies and delusions. And that is why, folks, I will not skip over a book like Lamentations. As much as I'm tempted to go on to better texts that I think would be more encouraging to you, I look at the false prophets in Jeremiah's day. They only wanted to talk about happy things. And because they didn't uncover their iniquity, that's why they're in the condition they're in. They envision lies and false prophecies and delusions. And now look where they are. It says, all who pass by, verse 15, clap their hands at you. They hiss and shake their heads at the daughter of Jerusalem. Is this the city that is called the perfection of beauty, the joy of the whole earth? That's the song they used to sing. Is Mount Zion on the sides of the north, the city of the great king, the joy of the whole earth? Now look what it's become. All your enemies have opened their mouth against you. Verse 16. They hiss and gnash their teeth. They say, we've swallowed her up. Surely this is the day we waited for. We found it and we've seen it. You know, and you can be certain that our enemies will dance in the street when we are humbled. When the towers fell, how many of the people in some of those nations had parties and celebrated and rejoiced? And the other ones feigned concern. The Lord has done what he purposed. You know, here's the thing. Verse 17. The Lord did what he purposed. He's fulfilled his word, which he commanded of old. In the days of old. What word? Well, Deuteronomy 28. The very beginning. When the nation got established, the law. He said, if you obey, these will be the blessings. If you disobey, these are the curses. And the curses are coordinated in such a way that at first they disobeyed, then it would be just like famine or the rain would stop for a time, get their attention. If that didn't work, then it would go to the next level. If that didn't work, it would go to the next until eventually he says he predicted in Deuteronomy 28 that it would get so bad. This is the description that the nation would be thrust out, that the women would actually eat their children. That the famine would get so bad, that it would be so horrible. But the Lord never wanted it to go down that road. He never wanted it to go that far. He said he warned them ahead of time. I'm giving you fair warning. Don't mess with this. But they didn't listen. So he had to do what he said he would do. He's thrown down and not pitied. He's caused an enemy to rejoice over you. He's exalted the horn of your adversaries. And their heart cried out to the Lord, O wall of the daughter of Zion, let tears run down like a river day and night. Give yourself no relief. Give your eyes no rest. Arise, cry out in the night at the beginning of the watches. Pour out your heart like water before the face of the Lord. Lift your hands toward him for the life of your young children who faint from hunger at the head of every street. Great counsel here. Cry out to the Lord. Ask him. Seek him. And he will be found of you. See, O Lord, and consider, to whom have you done this? Should the women eat their offspring? See, Lamentations records, Jeremiah is expressing, this happened, and this is what you said would happen. Should they eat their offspring, the children they have cuddled? Should the priest and prophet be slain in the sanctuary of the Lord? Young and old lie on the ground in the streets. My virgins and my young men have fallen by the sword. You have slain them in the day of your anger. You have slaughtered and not pitied. You have invited to this as to a feast day the terrors that surround me. In the day of the Lord's anger, there was no refugee or survivor. Those whom I have born and brought up, my enemies have destroyed. Now, you know why it's called Lamentations. This is a lament. This is a sad, sad, sad cry over the condition, the crisis in the nation. And they're trying to cope with it. And this is why this is written, to try to put some verbiage on what's experienced by them. But all the while, Jeremiah warned them before. They mocked, they laughed, they scorned. And right now, that's where our nation is right now when it comes to morality, to righteousness, to Christianity. They're laughing, they're mocking, they're scorning. And we need to speak up. We need to be faithful. To speak on behalf of the innocents that are murdered in the womb. To speak on behalf of righteousness. To care for the poor and the needy. To have a heart. You know, these are the things the Lord wants. You know, it's funny, one of the most liberal places in the United States, San Francisco, they portray themselves as tolerant. Yet, you know, when the USS Iowa was going to be moored there, the city council voted 8-3 to reject it because they disagreed with the Pentagon's policy prohibiting open homosexuality in the military. So they said, we're not going to let you. And of course, even their liberal senator thought that was petty. Then they attacked the Catholic Church for its opposition to homosexual adoption, calling it hateful and discriminatory and insensitive and ignorant. Then, this last week, they attacked the evangelicals. They had 25,000 evangelical youth with a two-day conference there in San Francisco, and a wonderful group called Teen Mania, and, you know, to inspire Christian youth for, you know, avoiding the cultural temptations of sex and drugs and, you know, wanting to be kids, you know, a new generation. 25,000. What a wonderful thing. Wouldn't that be wonderful if we had something like that out here in New Jersey? Awesome. But the city council, the city fathers, the protesters called it a fascist mega pep rally. And state assemblymen said the Christian kids were loud and obnoxious, disgusting, and should get out of San Francisco. This is the tolerant city. They're only tolerant of those things that they see and they want. And yet it's scorning righteousness. This is where we are moving, folks, more and more. But my big concern is, though we might say, oh, it's San Francisco, oh, it's the liberal, you know, media here in New Jersey. But you know what? The supply is there, folks, whether it's media, whether it's this worldly ways. The supply is there because the demand is there. And the demand is there also coming even from Christians. We ought to be ashamed to watch some of those things on TV. We ought to be ashamed to go down those roads, to even move in those directions. We need to distance ourselves from this. Lord, help us. Help us to take an honest look at ourselves and say, Lord, help me. I want to walk with you. I want to learn from this time in this funeral service where we're going as we study this book.